The setting sun filled the room at the top of the white tower with a peculiar blood-red light, a quality of light Utena Tenjo had only ever seen in this one room. She was aware on some unconscious level that this ought to make her uneasy, as indeed simply being in this room should do, but the notion didn't penetrate her actual awareness. In fact, she felt entirely secure, safe and looked after, as she reclined across one of the white leather couches, head against one armrest, and long legs outstretched across her sweetheart's lap, and outlined to him her plans for the future. "So I'll make you a deal," she said. "You stop trying out all these replacements that don't work, and go back to your old job, and just as soon as I'm ready, I'll come back and take over for good." With the sudden, easy energy of youth, she drew her legs in underneath her and sat up, draped her arms over his shoulders and leaned her head close to his, her fingers toying idly with the collar of his scarlet dress shirt. "How does that sound?" Griffin gave her a speculative look out of the corner of his eye, the glint of silver in his hair catching the sunlight when he moved his head, then grinned. "Works for me," he said, and then leaned to kiss her. "Hang on a minute. That's not right at all." Utena stood before a full-length mirror in her old dorm room, smoothing a sleeve, head tilted on one side. "I don't know," she said. "It's a little late to not know now," said Anthe in a bored voice from the top bunk of their bed. She flipped a page in the style magazine she was reading and added, "Fish or cut bait, darling?" No, Anthe wasn't there, and it didn't happen there anyway. Utena stood before a large, plain table of some dark red wood, while a white-furred, quite beautiful Seleucian woman looked her up and down. Outside the student council office's French doors, the Zeppelin regatta was in full swing. "This is quite a way to go, just to get your father to take you seriously," said the Seleucian woman, who wore a more ornate version of the same black-and-white uniform Utena herself was dressed in, with the starred epaulets of a vice-admiral. Utena shook her head. "That's not why I'm here, Admiral. I'm here for..." She searched for the phrase, then settled on, "for the good of the service." The Admiral looked puzzled. "I'm afraid I don't quite follow you." "May I speak frankly, sir?" said Utena. "I have difficulty picturing you speaking in any other way," the Admiral replied. "Out with it." "Admiral, I couldn't give a damn about being taken seriously. And even if it was something I had cause to worry about, it wouldn't be for my father. I'm not ashamed of the way I entered the IPSF. I think my record speaks for itself. But there are aspects of spacemanship that can only be learned from the bottom up, and I need to learn them before I can be a complete flag officer. I'm here because I want to learn my trade, not because I feel some yearning for street cred." The Admiral frowned thoughtfully. "You're a strange young woman." "I've heard that before." "But you do wear the uniform well, for a human. And there's no denying you swept the field in charm school. Admiral Rendiz endorsed your performance record himself, and that doesn't happen often." The Admiral thought a moment longer, then smiled with a hint of sardony and stood up. "All right, I'll see if anyone in my squadron is willing to take you on. But I warn you now, whatever positions you might have held in some other outfit aren't going to count for anything once you're thrown into the fleet. Nor your name, nor your family, nor even your connections at court."
"I'm counting on it, sir."
"That's a bit more like it." It took her 3 weeks to end up in a fight, and that was with trying as hard as she could to be on her best behavior. Anthe would have been dismayed, but at the same time she'd have been proud of the reason why. Utena knew on her first day aboard her Seleucian Majesty's light cruiser Vortigaunt that the fight was inevitable, but she'd tried to avoid it anyway, not because she was in any way concerned with her own safety, but because she hadn't wanted to put any of the people who helped her get this far on the spot.
"You must be the newcomer, the human."
The young Seleucian said it in a way that made it obvious how he felt about sharing the midshipman's berth of a queen's ship with an alien.
"I am the senior here. My name is Stovall. If you simply must speak to me, you may address me as Sir."
Swallowing her pride and calling the pompous bastard Sir wasn't easy, But then, she was here to learn just such lessons about life in the service, wasn't she? So she had. Truth to tell, ignoring his petty abuses and little spitefulnesses was easy, because his small-minded irrelevancy was plain to see, and because, though he was a physical as well as verbal bully with the other midshipmen, his own bigotry made him too proud to raise his hand to any creature as weak and inferior as a human female. He simply didn't feel she was worth it, and she simply didn't give a damn. Which was the way it went until she'd caught him whipping poor, mousy, undergrown Hardy Petillo with a knotted rope's end, a device Riley called a starter, for no evident reason. One of the many things about the Royal Navy that continued to strike her as odd was that that sort of thing was actually still allowed, as a sort of rough justice motivation. Most officers carried such a thing, and it wasn't unheard of for them to give an ordinary spaceman who wasn't snapping to in a satisfactorily lively manner, in action, a pop or two across the shoulders just to hustle him and his mates along. It made more noise than harm and was not generally taken as an insult, but officers, even the lowliest sort who hadn't earned their commissions yet and might never, weren't expected to go around starting each other, and particularly not off-duty, on a bare back, and for no reason at all. Utanen knew Stovall did it. Petillo was Vindari, so the blood showed clearly against his gray fur when he changed his shirt between watches, and he went about an obvious flinching terror of Stovall at all times. But she'd never caught him at it. When she'd mentioned it to Lieutenant Delaz, the fifth lieutenant, he'd taken her aside and told her in a kindly, vaguely conspiratorial sort of way that the midshipman's berth was expected to deal with such matters internally and not pester their betters with them. But by the same token, Delaz said before dismissing her and returning to the forward battery, no one outside the berth is likely to take it amiss if Mr. Midshipman Stovall misses a watch or two on sick call. So, really, when she caught Stovall red-handed, so to speak, what else could she do? It hadn't been a duel, obviously. That would have been a matter involving not one but several superior officers, and anyway would have had to be handled on shore someplace. She'd just taken off her sword and coat, put them on her bunk, and then gone across and given him a damn good hiding. It had been monumentally satisfying, and it had been easy, because despite his size and slightly superhuman strength, Stovall didn't really have the slightest idea what to do with his fist if his opponent didn't just stand there and take it, like poor Petillo. 3 weeks, Captain Kerwin said, observing the surgeon's report on Mr. Stovall's injuries. He looked up from the report at the pink-haired human who stood opposite his desk, neat bands of white tape across the knuckles of both hands. Then, as she was expecting him to burst out in fury, despite Mr. Delaz's advice, he chuckled darkly and said, "Well, we shan't have any more trouble from him, I dare say. But you just watch yourself, Mr. Tenjo," he added, rising. "I'm told Mr. Petillo and the other young gentlemen already half worship you. Keep attracting followers at this rate, and I may come to suspect you of masterminding a mutiny." But he was smiling when he said it. Smoke, fire, clanging alarms. There were no working exterior monitors in Number One turret, but from the sound of things, the third Klingon had pounded down their shields and grappled alongside. "Mr. Delaz, report!" The speaker next to the door crackled. Utana clambered over wreckage and punched the acknowledgement key. "Mr. Delaz is a casualty, Captain," she reported, her voice made hoarse by smoke and all the shouting she'd been doing for the last 20 minutes. "Very well, Mr. Tenjo," Kerwin replied without missing a beat. "Get down to the port side entry port with everyone you can gather who can hold a weapon and prepare to repel boarders." "Aye, aye, sir," Utana replied. She turned and took stock of her gun crew, a dozen or so still standing, their uniforms torn and dirty as hers undoubtedly was, all looking to her for leadership. "You said you wanted to be a rock star, honey," she said to herself wryly. Then she said aloud, "You heard the captain. We're leaving." Then she turned to the gunner's mate, who sat propped against the bulkhead next to the hatch, an improvised bandage around one thigh. "I'm leaving the turret in your hands, Stenner," she said. Stenner grinned, his teeth very white in the smoky semi-darkness. "I'll try not to misplace it, sir." The gun crew filed out one by one, ducking through the hatch. As Utana went to follow them, Stenner put out a hand and said, "Take this, sir. It sounds like you may need it." Utana looked and saw that he was holding out his personal weapon, a Martell heavy laser pistol. Seeing her hesitate, he pushed it toward her. "Please, sir. If the Clavarites get in here, it's not going to do me much good anyway." Giving the wounded gunner what she hoped was a reassuring smile, Utrin took the laser and hung it on her belt opposite the scabbard of her sword.
"Good luck, Mr. Tenjo,"
Stanner said before she could try to find words to thank him. She paused, nodding, and then ducked through the hatch. She found the survivors of Number 2 turret emerging from its base onto the gun deck some way aft. Their ranking officer was one of her fellow mids, Dennis Doreen, and though he was, like every other officer aboard, senior to her, he deferred instantly to her air of authority and assurance. Assembling their two crews and what few other survivors they found on the forward gun deck, the two midshipmen were leading the way aft to the entry port when they passed the brig, and Utina noticed that one of the cells was energized, a crewman inside.
"Keep going, Dennis," said Utina. "I'll catch you up."
"Are you mad?" Doreen demanded. "You can't be thinking of letting him out."
Utina blinked. "Well, I'm not leaving him trapped in a cage while the Clavarites storm the ship," she shot back. "Now go. I'll be back with you before they can breach the airlock." She had no idea who the man was. In 6 months aboard the ship, she had met relatively few members of the enlisted crew who weren't assigned to her section at the forward battery. But she had to admit that he did look pretty intimidating now that she got a better look at him. He was huge, and quite the most unkempt Seleucian sailor she'd ever seen, his face obscured by a great bushy black beard with two parallel white streaks in it. And his eyes, which glared out from beneath a beetling brow, were black and wild.
"What's your name, sailor?"
Utina asked as she started punching what she hoped was an officer's emergency override into the keypad next to his cell door.
"Teach, if you please, sir,"
the man replied in a voice that matched the rest of him, big and loud and slightly guttural, with an unusual accent she hadn't heard in a Seleucian's voice before.
"That's it? Just teach? What's your rating?"
"I haven't got one, sir,"
Teach replied stolidly.
"Ordinary spaceman. Well, I should say I haven't got one anymore, like. I've had several, but..."
He paused, then added with surprising good humor,
"I'm what they call a chronic disciplinary problem, like."
"What are you in here for?"
"Striking an officer," Teach replied unconcernedly. "But he had it coming," he added when she glanced sharply at him. "It were young Bransford the Fourth. Arrogant young pup."
Utina, who privately shared the hulking spaceman's assessment of Lieutenant Charton Bransford, finished overriding his cell barrier and said as he emerged, "Well, you'll get the chance to strike plenty of officers in a few minutes, so long as you don't mind their Klingons." Teach's ugly face broke into a huge, gap-toothed smile.
"I'd like nothing better, sir. Lead the way."
The man's reputation had clearly spread to much of the lower deck if it hadn't reached Utina yet, because more than a few of the survivors gathered near the portside airlock's inner doors looked startled and drew together when he came among them in her wake. The vibro-cutlass he'd collected from a boarding locker on the way looked like a toy in his giant fist. Utina remarked to herself that he'd have looked more appropriate with a Valyrian space axe like her friend Julius Vandergroat favored.
"Speaking of people I wish were here right now," she thought ruefully.
Then she said, "All right, people. Hear those noises? They're setting the charges now. When you see sparks start to come off the inner door, open your mouth so the blast wave doesn't burst your eardrums, and then be ready to fight, because the Klingons aren't going to wait for the smoke to clear. And remember, don't expect any quarter from these bastards. These are desperate men, traitors to their own kind. They're not the sort of Klingons one associates with honor." The gathered crewmen nodded gravely, fingering their weapons and trying to hide their nervousness. There were perhaps 36 of them now, men and women, all 3 major subspecies, but all Seleucians apart from Utina, which wasn't too surprising since she was the only non-Seleucian in the entire crew. She turned to Doreen, who stood next to her, eyeing Teach warily.
"Ready, Dennis?" she asked in a low voice.
"I'm glad you've done this before," he replied.
"Just remember what I taught you," she said. "You'll be fine."
The inner door glowed, then began to spark near the top.
"Get ready!"
Utina barked, leaving her jaw slightly slack. The sizzling sparks grew thicker and brighter, the noise louder, until with a sudden thunderous bang, the hatch blew inward, its fragments rebounding from the opposite bulkhead.
Two or three crewmen who hadn't heeded her advice clapped their hands to their ears and fell writhing to the deck. "Here they come!" she yelled to those that were left. Drawing her sword with one hand and handing Stannard's martel to Doreen with the other, she added that at the top of her lungs, "Long live the Queen!" I always expected I'd feel stupid saying that, but I didn't.
"Come on, you traitorous buggers!"
Teach roared as the first wave of Klingon boarders surged into the corridor. Pushing Doreen aside, he waded into them with such shocking violence that even the hardened Klingon Marines checked their advance and looked for someone smaller and less furious to fight.
"And when you get to Stovakor, tell your ancestors that Mad Ned Teach sent you!"
The Clavarite boarding party was led by their ship's second lieutenant, a young and powerful warrior and a recognized third-level master of the Batleth. Leaving his men to deal with Teach and the others as best they could, he hit the afterguard of the Vortigaunt's defenders like a scythe hits grain, opening a space for his marines to pour in behind him, and it looked for a few moments as if Utrina's first command position in the Royal Seleucian Navy was also going to be her last. But her people rallied and engaged the lieutenants more successfully, leaving him for some more experienced swordsmen to deal with. Someone like Mr. Midshipman Tenjo. Subcommander Katl sneered as he made for his obvious target, the only human aboard and the only one he'd ever heard of with that color hair in any case. Emperor Clavor had offered an instant promotion to command for any junior officer who brought her to him, and he, Katluk, meant to have that promotion. And what was there to stop him? A terrified rabble of Seleucian sailors and an old, battered, plain steel sword. He had heard that this Tenjo was a great swordswoman, and that she carried a weapon made by one of the finest smiths in the galaxy. If the latter were the case, she'd apparently left it in her quarters and met the boarders with an everyday knockabout blade instead. The one she held wasn't actually rusty, but it wasn't what you'd call polished either, and the scabbard at her belt looked positively disreputable. The broad corridor in front of the entry port cleared, dozens of smaller fights and the general swirl of the melee parting as if by some silent signal, as Katlach and Utina squared off. The Klingon lunged, expecting his weapon to penetrate her guard easily. Instead, it rebounded from a sweeping parry with a clang and a fat yellow spark that, he was shocked to see a moment later, had come from a chunk being taken out of his edge, not hers. Three more exchanges led to three more such blemishes on what had been. Until then, one of the finest Batleth money could buy, and Katlach's fury elevated with each one until he was almost blind with rage. Utrina evaded his next strike, crossed up his guard, and twisted the weapon clean out of his hands, then belted him across the face with her sword's plain steel disc pommel, dropping him to the deck. Her shipmates cheered around her and laid into their opponents with renewed vigor, gaining the upper hand in moments. The entry port yawned empty before her, the pulsing amber battle lighting of a Klingon ship's mid-deck visible beyond the melted edges of the inner hatch, and she suddenly realized what she had to do next. "Right, lads!" she cried as she stepped over the sprawled officer and made for the hatch. "Now we'll show them how you board an enemy man-of-war. Vortigaunts, follow me!" "Vortigaunt!" the others roared, charging after their leader without a second's thought. Katlach raised himself from the deck, tugging his disruptor from his belt. He'd had strict orders not to use power guns for this boarding because the Emperor wanted the human alive, but by Kalis, no one humiliated him that way and lived. But as he leveled it, trying to draw a bead on her pink hair through the shifting crowd of her shipmates behind her, a hand like a vice closed on his shoulder and dragged him bodily from the deck.
"Ah,"
said Teach in a mocking, chiding voice, and then he snapped the Klingon's neck with one hand, dropped him to the floor, and lumbered after the others. But I didn't find out about that part until later. As Utrina had suspected, the Klingon ship's crew was largely absent. Almost all those who had survived the hour-long battle with the Vortigaunt had been in the boarding party, and now lay dead or incapacitated aboard the Seleucian ship. With their blood boiling, the Vortigaunts were easily the equal of a force three times their size, and they carved their way to the D7's bridge, rolling over anyone who tried to bar their way. It fell to Teach, one of whose several lost ratings had been electrician's mate, to hotwire the bridge doors, and the Vortigaunt's spacers poured into that confined space like buckshot into a bag. Utrina led the way, elbowing and punching her way to the bullseye, and with the point of her shabby old sword to the captain's throat, she demanded his surrender in the name of the Queen. And something hit her like a sledgehammer in the side of the head, and everything went black. Well, that wasn't the shortest career on record, but it wasn't too distinguished, now was it? Stay alive, Corman said. I'll do my best, she replied, and she was just reflecting that she hadn't done a very good job keeping that promise, and it occurred to her to wonder whether he'd come to take her to Valhalla himself, if that would be allowed, and how awkward that would be. When she regained consciousness and realized that her head hurt too much for her to be dead.
Ugh, she said. Easy there, sir, said the gravelly voice of Teach, comically hushed.
A huge hand put a cool cloth gently to her forehead.
You gave us all a bit of a scare, like.
Utina opened her eyes and perceived the dim amber light of a Klingon sickbay, such as they were, and the oddly reassuring bulk of Teach looming over her. What he said next was even more surprising than how reassuring his presence was.
I'm sorry, sir.
Sorry? Utina put a hand to her head, holding the cloth in place, and sat slowly up. What for?
I didn't see the bugger what ate you until it was too late to stop him, Teach explained.
Then, with a slightly nasty smile, he added grimly,
But he won't be pulling that stunt on anyone else, I promise you that.
What did he hit me with? Utina asked, gingerly feeling at the side of her head.
Spanner, Teach grunted. Gave you a bit of concussion, but some vorpinol soon put you right.
Utina eyed him. How did you know to do that?
I used to be rated surgeon's mate, like, Teach told her.
Reaching to the table next to him, he picked up a steaming mug and handed it to her.
This should perk up your spirits some, sir.
Utina sniffed it, took a wary sip, then gave Teach a look of undisguised astonishment. Where did you find Belgad broth on a Klingon ship? Teach shrugged, looking slightly abashed at her admiration for the feat.
Wasn't that hard, sir? He mumbled. They like meat. Every ship has water aboard.
You made it from scratch?
I used to be rated cook's mate, like, he said.
Then, briskly, as if the topic made him uncomfortable, he added,
Now, sir, if you'll come along to the bridge, I think Mr. Doreen would appreciate your advice.
The bridge bore few traces of the wild melee that had been taking place when Utina had last seen it. Doreen sat in the center seat, his uniform rumpled and neckcloth absent. When he heard the door, he turned and nearly slumped clean out of the seat with relief.
Thank Althina you're all right, he said, rising. I'm in a hell of a fix.
What's up? She asked. He gestured to the viewer. See anything you recognize? Utina looked, sipping her Belgad broth, then gave Doreen a dubious look. Space? Is this a trick question?
Let me rephrase it. Do you not see anything you recognize?
Utina looked again. Where's the Vortigaunt? Doreen sat down again and looked glum.
I wish I knew.
I think the Klingons tried to warp to safety when we breached the bridge, but I have no idea where the hell we were, or how to find our way back there. The nav computer is blank and comms are smashed. He gave her a sheepish look and admitted, As you know, I'm not the midshipman's berth's strongest navigator. Utina chuckled. Doreen's regular wire brushings from the Vortigaunt's navigator, acerbic Lieutenant Jirov, over his botched calculations and creatively misaligned star sights were part of the ship's routine. Well, sir, she said, acknowledging his seniority with only slight irony, with your permission, I'll take over as navigator and see if I can't get a handle on that. Monday, June 27th, 2411. HMS Vortigaunt, SCS 3914. Disputed space near Klingon neutral zone. Captain Frederick Kerwin sat and gazed gloomily out of the forward windows of his bridge. Around him, the ship's routine was almost back to normal, field repairs mostly completed, and apart from a few blanked-off consoles that would require shipyard repairs and some lingering smudges of soot on bulkheads, it almost looked as if the ship's desperate fight with the Klavarite squadron hadn't happened. Well, apart from those and the startlingly large gaps in the ship's watch bill, the latest attempts to reorganize which Jurov was even now presenting for his approval. Kerwin looked them over, signed them, and handed the datapad back, then caught the lieutenant's eye and said bluntly, "You don't think I should stay here any longer, do you, Mr. Jurov?" "No, sir," Jurov replied at once. Whatever the lieutenant's personality lacked in warmth or likability, he wasn't deficient in honesty. "We've been loitering in this area for nearly 5 days now. Every further hour we linger without returning to base for proper repairs and replacement crew makes us still more vulnerable to another attack. The Klavarites know we're out here. One of their ships escaped. And Mr. Tenjo and her boarders are already dead. That's what you were going to say next." "Sir," Jurov drove on unflinchingly, "you know as well as I do that they were most likely outnumbered and outgunned. Leading a counterboarding was a bold thing for Tenjo to do, but it was also foolhardy. She hadn't a chance in 1,000. "If that's so, why did Doreen and the others follow her? He's senior to her, he could have countermanded her at any time." Kerwin knew what Jurov was going to say to that, too, but he wanted to make him say it. This sort of exercise benefited them both when it came time to decide on strategies. It had become a standard thing for them to do during their 5 years of service together. "Mr. Doreen may have held the senior of their two warrants, but we both know who the natural leader was. In the whole berth, not just between those two. She would have gone far had her enthusiasm been tempered by judgment." Jurov shook his head. "A tragic waste." Hazarding a personal opinion, he added, "I'd not want to be the one to explain it to the Queen." "Well, fortunately, Mr. Jurov, if you're right, that task will fall to me, not you," Kerwin said archly. Jurov blinked. "I apologize, Captain. I had assumed that Vice Admiral Kirk..." "I'm her captain, not Kanaya," Kerwin said, shaking his head. "If she has been killed in action, it's my responsibility to inform Her Majesty. And Mr. Tenjo's father, and her husband, and her wife, and her daughter." Jurov looked at the deck plates. "I'm sorry, sir," he said. "The remark was insensitive." "It damn well was," Kerwin agreed. Then, clapping the younger man on the shoulder, he added, "But it was also quite right. All right, Victor, I understand what you're thinking. But we'll give it a few more hours all the same. If any Klingon comes looking for us, we can show him our heels easily enough." Jurov drew himself up and saluted. "Aye, aye, Captain." He turned to return to his station. "Captain," the sensor operator on duty called. "New contact, bearing 322 Mark 74. Incoming starship at moderate warp speed, range 7200.
ID?
"Querying. No IFF. Warp signature indicates probable Klingon." "Hands to quarters," Kerwin snapped, straightening in his con. "Clear for action." 2 minutes later, the approaching ship dropped out of warp and approached within visual scan range on impulse power, and there was no mistaking the outline of a Klingon D-7, the same type of which they had recently fought three. That had been a good showing. They'd destroyed one, crippled one, and the third had fled, but they couldn't expect another showing like that. Not with the ship still half blown apart and the third of the crew either dead, in sickbay, or MIA. Turning to Jurov, he added, "Looks like you were right, Victor. Helm, prepare to withdraw. Maximum warp." Jurov regarded the approaching Klingon in the viewer for a few moments as the Vortigaunt maneuvered onto the best heading from which to make a run for home. But just before Kerwin would have given the order to engage, Jurov held up a hand. "Wait! Look at his running lights." He pointed, then began drawing on his long-ago experience as ensign of signals under old Admiral Korhiro to translate the international blink code. "VORTIGAUNT," he spelled out, then read off the rest of the message in words, a note of puzzled wonder in his voice. "Good to see you?" Utina materialized in the transporter room, with Doreen to her left and Teach to her right. Since the battle, the hulking spaceman had rarely left her side, and then not for any longer than he had to. Lieutenant Bransford, sent down to meet them, looked taken aback to see a man he'd confined to the brig suddenly appearing from an already unexpected Klingon prize. Teach merely saluted him without a trace of irony, but no particular deference either.
What's he doing here?
Spaceman Teach has been indispensable to the taking of the Klingon vessel and to prize operations since, sir, said Dorian before Utina could speak up. He's earned the right to report with us to the captain, if you please. Bransford blinked, then said, Very well, follow me. Their course took them past the midshipman's berth, and as they passed, Utina's sharp ear caught the familiar sound of a starter on flesh and a suppressed yelp comprised of as much general misery as actual pain. Setting her jaw pugnaciously, she detoured, slapped the door activator, took one step across the threshold, and barked in her most commanding voice, Mr. Stovall, I'll thank you to leave Petillo alone! From out in the hall, Bransford, Doreen, and Teach heard a high-pitched scream of terror and a heavy thud. Utina emerged a moment later, looking quite pleased with herself. Do you know, Mr. Bransford, she said, I get the distinct impression that Mr. Stovall had given me up for dead. Bransford tried without much success to hide his grin. I get the impression you are correct, Mr. Tenjo, he said. The foursome, with little Petillo now trotting delightedly after them, hastily tugging on his coat, emerged from the midship's companionway onto the bridge, where everyone who could come up with even the flimsiest excuse or pretense had gathered to greet them. And as Doreen and Utna saluted the quarterdeck and received Captain Kerwin's smiling salute in return, someone down in the gathering of crewmen at the front of the auditorium-like bridge shouted anonymously, Huzzah for Mr. Tenjo! Kerwin let them cheer, waiting until they'd finished before saying mildly, If you're quite finished, I'll trouble you to set course for home, gentlemen. Then, turning to his prodigal officers, he said, Mr. Doreen, you may return to your prize and conduct her to base. I'm afraid you'll have to get by without Mr. Tenjo for the last leg, though, as I require her here. Doreen hesitated, swallowing, and said, Thank you, Captain, but the capture is rightfully Midshipman Tenjo's. Without her initiative, the Klingon would never have been taken. Thank you, Mr. Doreen. I think I'm qualified to select prize crews, said Kerwin with a hint of asperity. Aye, aye, sir, Doreen said, saluting, and with a stricken, apologetic look at Utina. I tried. He took his leave. In his office abaft the bridge, Kerwin seated himself and said, As it happens, I agree with young Doreen. He's senior to you, but it's obvious from the hollow logs of the boarding action that would all have gone to pieces if he'd been the only officer there. Respectfully, sir, that's unfair, said Utina. Dennis does his best, and he never flinched. He consolidated our capture of the Klingon ship and made our situation there secure while I was out cold in sickbay. Kerwin smiled. Oh, I don't fault his courage, only his skill. He hasn't the sword arm to have stopped that Clavarite lieutenant, and you know it. Nor could he command the loyalty of a man like Teach. I won't ask how you manage that. I'm not sure I know, Utina admitted wryly. No, I imagine you don't, said Kerwin, but before she could ask him what he meant by that, he went on, Well, if you weren't already, this will make you a hero to every jack on this ship, and I told you before that that would never do. Utina eyed him, not sure where this was going. Sir? I'm afraid you'll be leaving the Vortigaunt when we get back to Salu II, Mr. Tenjo, said Kerwin, his enigmatic smile becoming somewhat less enigmatic. With Mr. Doreen promoted to take the late Mr. Delaz's place, I won't have a place aboard for another lieutenant. Utina blinked, then couldn't stop the grin from overspreading her face. Thank you, sir, she said. No need, Kerwin replied. You've earned it. It's part of my job to identify and reward the officers I think are the greatest assets to Her Majesty's Navy. I hate to lose you, but frankly you're too big for a little ship like the Vortigaunt. You need to move on to bigger and better things. He rose and held out his hand. But, congratulations, Lieutenant, and well done. She shook the hand, thanked him again, and, being dismissed, turned to leave. Just as she reached the door, his voice reached out and stopped her. Oh, one more thing, Mr. Tenjo. Utena turned. Sir? You may be interested to know that Spaceman Teach has already made plain his desire to accompany you to whatever your next posting may be. He seems to think you're destined for command one day, and I'm quoting here,
she'll need a good coxswain then, won't she?
Leading forward with his hands on his desk, he said, before you decide whether that's something you want, read his file. He's a 20-year spacer. The highest grade he's ever held was senior chief, and he's struck successfully for almost every rating in the book. But he's also loud, violent, and almost completely unsuited to naval discipline, which is why he no longer holds that grade nor any rating at all. It'll take a very strong and very special personality in an officer to control that weapon. There's a reason he's called Mad Ned. Sitting down again, the captain concluded, that said, he could be a great asset to the officer who has that personality, and I wish you'd take him. Kerwin cracked his wry smile again. For the good of the service. Mr. Midshipman Tenjo, For the Good of the Service. A New Frontier Mini-Story by Benjamin D. Hutchins. With apologies to Captain Frederick Marriott. Read by the author. Hope you've enjoyed it.